Well, we got Jason Panzer, CEO and president at, is it CEO and
president? And CFO.
President and CFO at Hexclad.
90% president, 10% CFO is kind of like the way my day works out.
Got it. Former investment banker and now leading, I think, the best DDC brand on the market. We always talk about how I love your gross margin profile and just the business. It's an amazing brand. Appreciate you coming today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm such a fan of Cuts. I mean, like, before I even got into this D2C game, back when I was a banker, a good friend of mine introduced me to your brand. I think it was 2018.
When we got started, yeah, you were a loyalist.
Yeah, and it's like, I remember, because it was, I think it was Devin.
Oh, Devin Levike?
Who was doing stuff with you guys
back then.
And you know, I've always been a fitness guy to some extent. You know, I kind of yo-yo around like most guys do, who are not pro athletes. But yeah, I've been following you forever. So like when we first started showing up at things together, I was like, Cuts, like, always had just a very inspiring story, Steve.
Appreciate it.
Glad to be a part of it.
Yeah. Jason, we've got to do panels together, PJ rides. And I really look forward to, just always, you know, those calls and chatting. So I'm excited to chat today.
Good.
So starting with your career and kind of your journey, as a young guy, you were investment banking. What was some of the, because I always say if I had to redo my career and I didn't know what I would want to do, I would get into investment banking, because you get to learn, you know, many different businesses, P&Ls, and you really get to understand business, I think, on a deeper level that, like, they can't teach you. The only way to do it is to kind of go through that career or start a business. And I think if, absent of starting a business, it's the next best thing to really learn. And where I think you may even learn even more is that you're sort of learning on someone else's dime in a way of like, or pitfalls of certain businesses, and you know how to analyze one. So what were some of the biggest lessons in that you've learned? Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I spent 12 years as a tech investment banker in M&A. I mean, there's a lot to unpack with what you just said. I think we can have a really fruitful conversation about it. I actually started my career as an M&A lawyer, and then I pivoted from a lawyer to banking. And when I got into banking, I realized that being a good investment banker is a combination of two totally separate and distinct skills. One is sales and marketing, and the other is execution. And that's what the best business owners have too. A good business owner is the number one salesperson and the number one executor. And that was something that I had to learn. Like, I had to learn the sales and marketing side, because actually being an M&A lawyer, and I worked on huge deals. I worked on the Citigroup Travelers merger. I worked on the bailout of long-term capital management, the hedge fund back in 1997, where everyone thought, wow, like, the financial markets were going to like come to an end. There's a great book written about that called When Genius Failed by Roger Lowenstein. Super cool. But that execution piece that you learn as a banker or a lawyer is incredibly valuable in business. I mean, like, I had this one senior lawyer who I worked for, and every time I left his office, he would say, "Just get it done, Jason, just get it done." And he'd be almost like muttering it under his breath, right? But in terms of the investment banking training, I think you're really right about that. Like, I think the best... If you said to me, Jason, pick where to hire someone to do anything right now, I would go to a bulge bracket investment bank, and I would find someone who was really good, who's done like a 3-year analyst program. Those people are incredible. My COO, Niles, he was a JP Morgan banker. And these guys, first of all, they know how to grind. Guys and girls, like, the women investment banking, I managed a lot of women investment banking, and they crushed. It was like, there was never even a question, male, female, whatever. No, everyone was just a killer. And so those people, tremendous work ethic, ability to learn, willingness to learn, and really very well-rounded skill set. Because it really is, half their time is spent doing sales and marketing, half their time is spent in execution. And that's really what makes a good business owner or manager, those two separate and distinct skills. But to really make money in investment banking, you've got to have both of those.
And what was there a story you have of just like a deal that didn't go through that you were like, man, like that can never happen to Hexclad? Like that really stings in your memory of like, shit.
Well, it's funny. We talk about there's two things that kill deals. One we always say, time kills all deals. And this applies to everything, not just big corporate transactions, right? Because if you allow too much time, some kind of intervening event, you know, just blow the whole thing up. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember every time we would close an M&A deal, like up until the money hit the bank, we weren't counting on that deal getting done because anything could happen. You could have a market crash. I lived through stock market crashes in my career, like big ones.
Yeah.
And just stuff stops. Global financial crisis, dot-com era, like all these big crashes. Like, so if you allow too much time, and some people, like, I understand you want to be thoughtful about your decision-making process, but sometimes you just got to go, you know? Just got to get it done.
Yeah, and I feel like that's a good lesson, too, just for business. Time kills things. Where, like, if you have an initiative that you want to do, you just got to get it done. We talk about that all the time at Cuts, where if we put an initiative out there and it's been on, you know, the OKR sheet for too many weeks, it's time to go. I don't want to keep seeing that. That's one of my pet peeves.
But the other thing on that, on like the lessons, which I think people really find useful, it's the number one way to kill a deal is to miss your numbers. It's the number one way to kill your deal. And it's overpromising and missing is the worst. And I remember as a banker, a lot of people showing the hockey stick progression, you know, and they're just not credible. But even that, like that just shuts down conversations right away. But I'm talking about like when you're in the middle of a transaction or you're in the middle of a deal, hit your numbers. Like just so don't
work in some buffer.
Yeah, just like work in a buffer, like really get overperform. It's like people just, they're greedy, right? They want to push for the highest valuation possible. And like, they don't realize that's, they're taking a lot of risk. You push the envelope too hard. What happens? You know, boom, it blows up.
Yeah. And I think Cuts has definitely seen, you know, at one point our first, you know, 4 years, we didn't see less than 100% growth. And that just became the standard for what we did. And I think in 22, one, turning those, as the numbers get bigger, it gets harder and harder.
Sure does.
And the risk gets bigger. And I think it's almost like when things go too well, you kind of get a little bit soft because you start doing things, you start cutting corners, then you don't realize you cut corners. And then all of a sudden you don't know where you are. Sometimes when the market or when your business kind of goes through a period of kind of refinement and buckling down, that's when like you can really feel, okay, you can feel how the wheels turn again. And I think I'm super, super, super grateful for those periods because those almost now as I've been more mature in business get me more excited because then you can see, okay, man, now that we actually know how to do it, we're not just more or less lucky. You can really see the future a little bit clearer.
Such an insightful line that you just went through. Like I always say, by the way, the harder you work, the luckier you get. You talked about the luck, mm-hmm. but it's true. When everything is going well, you just have a lot of room to make mistakes, mm-hmm. and you might not even know you made them because everything
until it's too late.
Like one of the Twitter people that I follow, I like Twitter a lot. I haven't been tweeting as much lately, but like someone said, you know, a good product can make up for a lot of bad management. Mm-hmm. That's part of what you're saying. I think
totally.
A good bit, you know, when you have first of all, everything starts with a good product. That's why Cuts is here. That's why you and I are sitting here today, because you guys have a great product and we have a great product. You have product market fit. You have to have a great product. You have to have product market fit. And then you have to be able to do it at unit economics that makes sense, right? Otherwise, like, why bother? Mm-hmm. But we went through, since I got involved with Hexclad over 4 years ago. I mean, I was an advisor of the company for a couple of years mm-hmm. as they were getting going. And then when it really just started to take off, I was just so excited by the opportunity. I gave up my career in investment banking to come sell pots and pans. Part of it is the fact that my best friend Cole and another great friend Danny, like they started Hexclad, and they deserve the vast majority of the credit for getting it to where it, you know, was. And I've been blessed to have the opportunity to really help them scale it from, you know, we probably by the end of this year we will have 20x'd the business from when I joined. And but with that incredible growth in 2022 and 2023, which was great because a lot of people were worried about a pandemic pop and then having us, you know, go back. And it has not been the case for us. In fact, we grew faster in 22 than we did in 21.
Wow.
But there is, you see, like you said, the law of large numbers starts to kick in. And when we're putting up incredible growth numbers, by best-in-class growth numbers, by anyone's standards, they're still not what I was used to, right? So then it's like, okay, what's happening? Is it just the law of large numbers kicking in? What have we done differently? What do we need to do differently? And now we need to just be better. That's what I've been talking with my team about. It's like, you know, we were all breaking our arms, patting ourselves on the back in 22 and 23 with what we did. And like we had a really nice Q1. But you can see the law of large numbers kicking in on our business. And it's like, okay, so what do we do now to be incrementally better every day? And I think there's this evolution. Every year, your business levels up, and then you have new challenges.
Yeah, there's always a new fire to fight.
Yeah, right? new. I call them challenges, but
What was the conversation like when you were kind of crossing that chasm between advisor to moving into business? And is there anything to learn there of, like, you know, calling your shot and be like, hey, I want to do that? Did you have to sell, or like was there any advice you had for someone that wants to get involved in the business?
Yeah. Well, first of all, like, building personal relationships over a very long period of time. If I haven't been doing that my whole professional career, I would have never been at Hexclad.
Yeah.
Cole, one of the two co-founders of Hexclad, I knew him since 1995. And we were very, very close friends. But he lived in LA, I lived in New York. Like, it's not like we saw each other every day. But we always kept in touch. And I have this thing on the Operators podcast, and I do these panzerisms. I have a few of these things.
I love it.
And one is building a bank of favors.
Yeah.
I like to do 10 favors for someone before I even ask for one. Mm-hmm. And hopefully I never actually have to ask. Most of the time I don't have to ask. But I built the bank of favors, right? And so I kind of built the bank with Cole over the years by just being a good friend. And
just over-delivering.
Always, you know, if he needed me, out of the goodness of my heart, I've done this for a lot of people because I've been very, I'm grateful. I'm fortunate. I'm going to be 53 years old next month, and I've seen a lot. You know, graduated law school in 1997.
Wow.
I've been around the block, and I've made lots and lots of personal connections. So every job I've ever gotten or every opportunity I've ever gotten came from not my resume. It came from my personal worth and, of course, people understanding my accomplishments.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it came to me joining Hexclad, I could just see that the stars were aligning for this business.
Yeah.
I saw it early. And I actually told Danny and Cole that I'm like, this business is going to be worth multiple hundreds. Like, I won't give you the number, but
let's just say a couple billion.
Multiple hundreds of millions. Back in 2020, I said, this business will be worth multiple hundreds of millions in a year if we do it properly, but you need help. Mm-hmm. And Cole, just from my relationship with him over the years, he was like, well, if Jason's interested, we should bring him on. And Danny didn't know me as well. And Danny and I are like brothers now.
Homies now,
you know. We laugh all day long in the office. But Danny needed a little bit of convincing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And
Danny's the founder.
Danny and Cole are the two co-founders.
Yep.
But Danny Danny was like fully invested from the beginning where Cole was working another job.
Got it.
And Danny was, you know, Danny was a CEO. Like when they set it up, it was like Danny was going to be in charge, and that's the way, you know, that's the way it all worked out. But one of the best things that anyone has ever said to me is about a year and a half after joining Hexclad, you know, Danny had said to me, like, you know, I was reluctant to bring you on board, but now, and this is the best equity I've ever given away to have you come on board. And we just had a big meeting with a partner of ours, and Danny's great at telling the Hexclad story, and he did that. Like 45 minutes up there in front of a room of 20 people, just like telling the Hexclad story. But he went out of his way to say, like, in 2020, two really, really important things happened in Hexclad. One was the pandemic, and one was Jason Panzer joining the team.
What I love about that story is, and you don't hear about stories like that as frequent anymore, and I think it's because you had a large amount of patience getting to know the guys over time. And when that opportunity came, if you hadn't built that bank up, it would have never been there. And when I hear stories like that, it encourages me to just have a lot of patience in business. You've been around for a long time, and you know, business is long. It doesn't happen. You know, you hear these. I think over the last 5 years, you hear these stories going, you know, businesses exiting in 2 years and stuff like that. And I think that's really bad for business. Where Cuts is almost 7 years old now, and you know, I feel like we just launched the business. Like it just started, and I think that perspective has helped me just make longer term decisions on the business and not trying to chase all of it at once. I think that's at times in early part of Cuts, I've wanted to have it all right now. Or, you know, I'm in a group chat with, you know, these businesses that are bigger, and I'm like, how do we do that? How do we do it right now? And now just, you know, put it in the bank, understanding, okay, that might be for in a year or two or 3 years, it'll come, but we gotta do, you know, X, Y, and Z first. And I think, you know, when I talk to younger founders, I always try to tell them that is act like quick baby steps. Do the baby steps as quick as you can, but over the long term, don't try to get it all at once.
You know, you make a great point about patience, and I think there are a lot of people that are, especially we work with a lot of younger people. Yeah. I think I'm way older than most of the people that work for me these days. It's funny. I don't feel old, but I am. And yeah, I've got like incredible people on our team, and like they've been with us for 12 months, 14 months, and they're like, you know, where's my title? Where's my equity? Where's this? Where's that? And these are great people. Yeah. Like they are really good people, but they just don't have that perspective of patience. And it's funny because like my son graduated UMiami last year, and he's a really good marketing guy. He's a good, you know, he's got a really good. He's got
what a career gift to get into.
He's a gift. He's got a gift of like being able to talk to anyone.
Yeah.
But he also, you got to grind. Like you got to grind. And the thing that I wasn't sure about him, because, you know, he's a kid. Mm-hmm. Like I know he's got that. I know he's really smart and very personable. But is he going to grind? And he got a job working for a digital agency in New York. And we were talking about his comp and stuff like that. I'm like, dude, don't even think about how much they're paying you for 2 years. You just go in there and work. Arguably, you should be paying them for the experience to work. And you will take that and you will take it very, very far. So
totally.
He's got that mentality from me.
That's so important.
And he also has me to fall back on financially if he needs to, because I want him to be set up for long-term success. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of young people who, you know, they're like 22, 23, and like there's just zero patience. And maybe it's a part of the digital world that we live in now. But
and there's a lot of smoke and mirrors of this guy having this, and it's not the case.
Yeah, you know, posting the watches and the cars on Twitter and stuff like that. But one thing that, as that relates to business in general, and the point that you made, is this is another thing that I say all the time. You've got to build a business that you want to own forever.
Yeah.
And maybe you sell it one day. Maybe you IPO it. But if you build that, and the only thing you're thinking about is, okay, how do we exit? How do we exit? How do we exit?
You're going to make
You're just going to make it much harder. It might work. You know, you get lightning in a bottle. You get the right thing. but it's so much easier and you're negotiating from so much more strength. We have turned down many, many offers mm-hmm. at Hexcloud. People just like, I come from the finance background. I know a lot of PE people. Mm-hmm. I'll have once a quarter, I'll just like have a conversation with mm-hmm. someone. It's good for me to exercise that muscle too, yeah. right? And we've gotten some pretty good ones that we turned down just because we felt like we had a lot more in the tank mm-hmm. and we still do. But that's because we had such a strong business yeah. that we don't have to do anything. We don't have to ever sell Hexcloud. Mm-hmm. We could cash run this forever it, yeah. if we want to. That's the way to build a business for the long term. And that's a mentality, and it requires patience, as you mentioned.
And you start, and by doing that, you focus on the right things. You know, I think if you're trying to sell a business, you might, you know, optimize towards growth at all cost. And then what does that all cost mean? Is it, you know, shitty product for the customer? Is it, you hire the wrong people? There's a million things, and we've definitely learned our lessons on that of just, you know, again, going too fast. On the workplace, like culture, I love that about training your son of, hey, don't think about comp. Don't worry about title. Focus on, you know, the scope of work you're doing and the learning in the early part of your career. Because we've hired, you know, tons of young people, and the ones that don't have that aggressive title chase are usually the ones that end up getting the titles that they want, because they're really focused on creating value. What do you think is some of the biggest, like, worries that you have with the new entrance into the market of the employee world?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's just become a lot more of, let's say, a focus for me and really senior management at Hexcloud to, like, manage these young people and get the most out of them and make the most rewarding environment for them. But, like, I'm just cut from a different cloth, mm-hmm. having grown up in big law and investment banking.
In New York, right?
In New York.
Yeah.
And so, like, and my COO, Niles, he's a former JP Morgan banker.
Yeah.
So, like, we're like two peas in a pod when it comes to, like, just buckling down, getting the work done and grinding it out and like, not complaining. You know, that's just the way we are. But that doesn't, we have to be aware that that's just not for everyone.
Yeah.
And so how do you get the most out of your people, out of these, you know, these different generations of people? You know, it's challenging. Mm-hmm. It's challenging for me. But I think you're an inspirational leader. Mm-hmm. You have to have inspirational leadership at the top of the organization to be like the North Star for these people. Mm-hmm. Because you work at Cuts in a good, even if you're a junior person, right? Mm-hmm. There's some other brand out there that needs to hire for a role, and they'll call their recruiter and be like, "Oh, look at LinkedIn and see who's got Cuts in their name." Like,
yeah, well, that's getting, happened to us, before.
Right? And they start getting calls.
Yeah.
And so, the only thing you can do is create an environment where, like, people feel valued, people feel a part of something special and bigger than them, and unfortunately, not everyone is going to buy into it, but mm-hmm. like really focusing on getting people to buy into that vision is something that's really important to me for 2024. Mm-hmm. In 2023 and 2022, I was very focused on our customer. Mm-hmm. Now I have to also focus on our people and our organization, and that's different than what I typically would do. But we've scaled our people very hard. We ran a very lean team.
How many people are you up to now?
We're like a smidge under 200.
Wow.
Yeah. But that's because we have 75 plus roadshow sales reps, because we sell in Costco. And that's a very special business. That,
what percentage of the business is that revenue?
Costco is in the minority for sure. I don't want to give out the actual percentage, but
no secrets.
Like our D2C business, like website and Amazon, is over 80% of our business. But still, we're a big business, and so every relationship counts.
What was, and I think at one point when we first met, you mentioned that coming out of 2020, you guys like ran out of cash or something like that, or you had like a war story. Do you want to go in a little bit more detail to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a funny one. It's not that we ran out of cash, but it was. I like to joke around that I almost bankrupted
the company.
And that's because I've been a CFO before. I was CFO of a tech company, and I've been a bank, you know, tech banker. I never really dealt in physical products. Mm-hmm. And so the working capital dynamics of a business like Cuts or Hexclad are much different than a software company. I mean, at software companies, you very often, like, you bill annually in advance. You run negative working capital.
Yeah.
Like, I used to sell software companies, and, like, buyers would actually, like, pay above, like, the purchase price because of the negative working capital, as opposed to having a working capital adjustment down, which you see a lot. So when I was sort of thinking through what our balance sheet should look like, being a tech CFO and a tech banker, when you're growing as fast as we are, put it this way, if you're growing 100%, and let's just say you have 25% profit margins, and you have 25% COGS, well, guess what? Every single penny of this year's profit is going into the stock, the inventory to support next year. I mean, you know it better than anyone.
Yeah.
It's like we were talking about earlier, EBITDA versus cash flow, free cash flow can be very different, difficult, especially if you're growing really fast, because you're just plowing everything back into inventory. And and we see this, and it's in a lot of the chats that I'm in and probably you're in. It's like, we're making tons of money and we're not able to take any of it out because it's all being...
Because if you're growing, even at the rate of what your EBITDA is, you got to save that money to buy future inventory.
Exactly. So that was something that, like, that I learned the hard way.
Yeah.
But it's more like, you know, we're a closely held company and, and you know, taking money out and then having to put it back in and stuff like that. And it was, but it was a pretty big miss on my part. And it just goes to show you, like, everyone fucks up sometimes.
That makes me feel good, because we had a similar issue. And I think I'm very grateful for that coming out of 2020, 2021, like supply chain, you know, balance sheet issues. Because, you know, I think I had a very elementary view as a CEO of how to run the business from a financial standpoint. You know, coming out of, you know, I got a marketing degree. Cuts was really, like, you know, I started the business when I was 25, and not knowing the difference between, you know, looking at a balance sheet versus free cash flow versus EBITDA versus net income, how, you know, all of those questions, you know, probably cost us millions of dollars. And I was joking with my dad. I said, you know, I should have paid attention a little bit more in those statistics classes, but now I have, like, a, you know, I made a joke, a $5 million statistics degree of just, like, you know, so mistakes we've made. And I've, you know, learned it the hard way. And with a business like ours, like, we're really focusing on how do we use our factories to get to use our terms, and our goal is to it's going to be hard, but our long-term goal is to have a negative working capital structure where, you know, we're selling the inventory before we would ever have to pay for it. It's going to take many years, but I think with growing business, having good suppliers and that want a piece of that action, in a way, you can get there. It's just, you know, it takes time. Can't happen overnight.
And you're pointing out, I think, a very valuable lesson to people who are either in the startup world or just, like, running a young company or a small business that wants to grow. It's like, got to know your numbers. Mm-hmm. You got to know the numbers. And you come from a marketing background. I come from a legal background. Okay. I got my MBA and did all that. And I, like you said, oh, I should have paid attention. I actually did exactly what you said you should do. I went back to school. I learned all that.
I probably should have got
my MBA at Columbia Business School in 2000. Cause I wanted to learn that stuff, cause I knew how valuable it would be for me. Mm-hmm. But that's, I mean, kudos to you, because there are a lot of founders who they're okay with their limitations and say, all right, I'm just, like, this is for someone else to figure out, and I'll just hire the people and do it. But, you know, adapting, yourself as a leader and a manager and an owner to be like, oh, I have to learn this bit. I have to learn that bit. There are all these bits I have to learn. Mm-hmm. Like I always say, when with me coming out of the tech world, like I could do anything at a tech company, any mm-hmm. job except write code.
Yeah,
definitely. Though I'm not learning something new. What I'm trying to learn now is how to play golf well. I'm not learning how to write code.
You and me both.
But like being able to do just about every job at the company is really like. When you're the founder, that's exceptional. Like if you look at mm-hmm. all of the incredible business stories and see what happens to the various founders, like Zuckerberg is a great example because he's still.
I think he knew how to code too.
You know what I mean? He's still running the thing, mm-hmm. right? It's a pretty rare exception that the founder, because a lot of times the business outgrows founders.
Yeah.
It's just normal. Or the founder just decides, you know what? I'm good. Mm-hmm. Right. But those stories where the founder like takes their lumps, learns and masters all aspects of the business. Like it's hard to do, but those are like the really exciting, fun stories, I think.
Getting more into like business and marketing strategy. You guys did a deal with Gordon Ramsay, and right at kind of that pinnacle of growth, what was that like from, like, how did you go about choosing him? Mm-hmm. And me and you know this, but maybe for the viewers, like that organic side of the relationship, like yeah. how did you guys start it and what's made it so successful?
Well, I'll start with the reason why we were able to get Gordon. Well, there were two things. Number one, we had a good business already. Mm-hmm. And so we could talk the language of business that his management team could understand, like profit, right? Mm-hmm. Like we make money. And then he was convinced that we had a good product and probably in part because we had a good business. You know, when I get on, I'm one of these people that I don't mind like throwing our numbers out there because they're so good. And I'm not going to like broadcast big numbers on a podcast, but like when I'm in a business meeting or I'm hanging out with you or other guys in the chats, because we all share.
Yeah.
But so when we talked to Gordon and his team, I mean, I remember the very first call that we had with Gordon. We talked to his team a few times mm-hmm. and then Gordon, it was still in the pandemic and Gordon was at his house in the south of England in Cornwall. And Danny and I were in separate locations and Gordon in the UK and Gordon's manager in the UK. And we all get on this Zoom call. And it was like really incredible. Like we all sort of had chills because he is the Michael Jordan of cooking.
Yeah.
And we are a cookware company. And I'll come back to that in a second. So we found Gordon just through social.
Through the DMs.
His account was following ours.
Yeah.
His account was following ours. And the guy who was running our social at the time, he's like, did you know that Gordon Ramsay's account is following us? And we're like, that's pretty cool. He's like, well, should I reach out to him? We're like, yes. Yeah, do. And, you know, someone on Gordon's team. So Gordon checks his Instagram for sure. I know. And then he also has a social media manager who we've all become very close with. So I'm not sure who, we still don't know whether it was Gordon or a social media manager, but someone got back to us.
It doesn't matter.
And then next thing you know, I mean, it's in the middle of the pandemic. We get on this, I think Danny spoke to Gordon's manager first. And then when we started to get into some numbers, his name was Michael. Danny's like, Michael, talk to Jason. And then I got, you know, I put my investment banker hat on.
Yeah.
And I was just.
You were selling.
I was just selling what a great business we had. And because I had the goods. I had the goods.
Your balance sheet was all in order.
It was all good. P&L, yeah. Our numbers were great. We were profitable already. And I'm like, look, we're not going to give you some Series C equity at some crazy valuation that maybe one day will be worth something for you. I'm like, no, we're not going to write you a seven-figure like endorsement deal, mm-hmm. but we'll make you a partner, and you'll make way more money. You'll make like 100x. Over time, if this goes right. And so we had that Zoom call And Gordon Ramsay is an incredible, incredible
He's
guy.
A presence, I mean, when he walks
is,
in.
He is, no question,
yeah.
is he a presence. But he's so incredibly talented, and he has so much energy. He is a Michelin star chef, and he is also an incredible entertainer at the same time. Like, that's hard.
That's the billion-dollar recipe.
And that's and that was and plus he's edgy, you know, and we always
you kind of need that.
We
though,
always
right?
thought of Hexclad as like the badass cookware. At least that's Danny used to say that all the time. Like, Danny had this this vision is there's a Johnny Cash picture of him getting out of Folsom prison and give him the finger. And like all the people that turned down, like Danny and Cole tried to raise money early on, like no one would give them money. Like, they were like, cookware, get out of here, you know?
Little did they know.
Right? and now we're, you know. So Gordon matched up with that. You know, Gordon is an incredible guy. He's actually really a sweetheart. Mm-hmm. He's not mean. But he also doesn't suffer fools and just doesn't suffer like bad performance. Mm-hmm. So that's how he is on the TV shows. That's how he is in real life. He's a sweet, genuine person. He's also like incredibly busy. I mean, the amount of energy that guy has. I mean, he is everywhere. I don't know how he does it. You know, he's shooting in the UK. Oh, I got to go to Kuala Lumpur. Oh, I got to get to LA for
Vegas
the
Vegas or
for
something,
the,
right?
Yeah, he's got multiple restaurants in Vegas. Hell's Kitchen in Vegas is the number one grossing restaurant in Vegas.
Wow,
it's incredible, and it's delicious. By the way, the food's great. It's very hard to get a table. He has a few others in Vegas. He's got dozens of restaurants in the UK. He's got a few others in the US. But yeah, he's just like an incredible presence. And so, you know, right place, right time. And we had a great business already. And we sold them on the vision of what we could do together. And we delivered on our side. And to Gordon and his team's credit, they are very, very committed to Hexclad. Like with Gordon,
are they in product development, and do they like hey, what do you think about this or this?
Gordon and Danny talk a lot. I see Gordon 3, 4, 5 times a year. Danny and Gordon have become very good friends. So, you know, Gordon will just see something and call Danny and like, "Oh, are we doing this? You know, like what about this? Like, we're doing our apron line and our apparel." Yeah. And Gordon's like, "Oh, we need to do the best chef code, and we need to do this." Or like this appliance, like, have you thought about doing this? So he's very committed to Hexclad, and he's very enthusiastic about Hexclad. And we'll send product to all of his restaurants and his chefs.
And they love it.
Try out our stuff. Yeah. And they love it. And it's a really funny story because his 3-star Michelin restaurant in London is his number one restaurant, Gordon Ramsay. It was his first restaurant. And look, Gordon's not cooking in the restaurants anymore.
Yeah.
But Gordon's going in and quality controlling the restaurant.
And he'll let you know if he doesn't like it. Know.
But we were in, Danny was in London actually on this trip, and he went to dinner at restaurant Gordon Ramsay, and Matt, the executive chef there, who's an incredible chef in his own right, Matt Abe. Whenever we go to any of Gordon's restaurants, someone takes us into the kitchen. It's really nice. Like when I go to London, the Savoy Grill, they take me in the kitchen. It's a lot of fun. That's one of the fun parts about the job is like, meeting all these chefs, going in these kitchens, you know, being fed all this amazing food. But Matt brought Danny into the restaurant Gordon Ramsay, 3 Michelin star kitchen. And it's like, I just want to show you. And they're cooking on Hexclad. Mm-hmm. And no one told us. They didn't call us. They're just like, someone said, oh, send some pans to restaurant Gordon Ramsay. And we didn't even think about it.
Yeah.
And then lo and behold, they love the product. They're cooking on the product right there. So he knows he's
so
pitching something good.
To see real best-in-class people using the product for product development or just making the product better, I'm sure.
Yeah, and we it's funny because we really are a consumer brand.
Yeah.
I mean, like, the consumer is a bigger market than the restaurant market. And we, for many years, we were selling everything, so we didn't have time to... We didn't even have inventory to sell to restaurants. We're starting to dabble in it now. But what we're seeing is really good chefs want to get involved with Hexclad now. Like, we run events now.
That's amazing.
And like 2 years ago, we were like, oh, we'd love to talk to this chef. We're running around trying to talk to this chef and that chef. And not because we wanted to sell them anything, because we don't want to sell to chefs, but just like get them on under the tent and let's see. So like, for example, very recently, Nancy Silverton, who's a big name here in LA, Osteria Mozza. She started La Brea Bakery back in the day. She worked for Wolfgang Puck. I mean, she is like an icon in the culinary world, Michelin star, et cetera. She signed on to be part of the Hexclad Culinary Council. Dominique Krenn, who is the only woman in the United States with 3 Michelin stars, she signed on to be a part of the Hexclad Culinary Council. And that's because they love the product.
And what I think gets me excited about that is, you know, Cuts, we have athletes that wear our stuff and similar. We have a great product and they want it. I think we're still looking for our Gordon eventually that we can bring in as a partner. And I think you guys did it well. On Running has done it well with Roger Federer. And I think the same story they had is Gordon is, you know, he's in there designing his shoe. He's in there. I listen to this podcast that he's there like 20 some days a year. And I think with a celebrity or athlete endorsements or partnerships, it has to be organic where they're all in, not just for the one-off transaction, but for the long-term gain of the brand. And then it can be very fruitful. So, you know, we've been patient, you know, I think trying to rush towards like maybe the first guy that wants to do it isn't the best way. But finding that person that you're like, you know, I see this guy for the next 10 years that he's going to really help us grow. I think that's the only way you can do it. Cause when it's so transactional, the customer can smell that out and know that it's not legit.
Oh, I mean, there's so many of them, right? Like we look at, everyone seems to have their own cookware line these days.
Yeah.
Like Paris Hilton is giving away her cookware on like Venice Boulevard, like pulling up in a truck, like giving out cookware.
Just to get rid of it.
And like Stanley Tucci, who we love, by the way, we were like, oh, it would be great to work with Stanley Tucci at some point. And like, we never got around to it. Mm-hmm. We just first, you know, and then like all of a sudden he's got his name on some other, it's like, these are not good products. You know, there are some companies out there that like they make their living out of doing like celebrity endorsed products and they do a good job with it.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's great. But like, know what you're doing. You're not like, you're not creating a great product.
Or a great brand at that point.
Yeah. But you know, what you point out is about being patient, about finding that person. Mm-hmm. And moreover, just the timing, like you kind of have to get lucky.
Yeah.
In a way. Like Nike got lucky with Jordan. I mean, like say what
you
want. Yeah,
they could have gone with Sam Bowie.
Say what you want. Yeah. Like lightning striking. They got struck by lightning. You know, we got lucky in that respect with Gordon. Like we'd still have a great business today, but you know, Gordon was like rocket fuel to our business. Wouldn't have happened if we didn't have a good product, but it's also right place, right time, and it may never happen. For you may never find that one, but if anyone should, Cuts should, because it's just a great product. Like everything starts with a great product.
Yeah.
You know, I wear your shirts. I love your shirt. Like I literally have, I have a million shirts. Like I like have a rotation of 10 Cuts Henley. I love Henleys, you know, I'm wearing a collar shirt today, a polo today, but like I love Henleys. Mm-hmm. And I think probably every color that you make in Henleys and some I have 3 colors because like it feels great, it looks good, I can dress it up or down, and I think you will eventually you keep getting looks, and then eventually you will find that one. Mm-hmm. Who is like, oh, this is the perfect fit for us, and it's all about timing.
And I think I see a lot of younger brands do it from like the day they were founded. And that, I think long term that becomes a negative, because if the brand's not big enough in the early stages, like it's the brand for Hexclad, it's still Hexclad with Gordon. It's not Gordon Ramsay's brand.
Correct.
You know, the brand equity was strong enough where they, you know, he could ride alongside and it could be a beautiful partnership. Yeah. I mean, there's so many in the fashion space where they sign you know, an athlete or a celebrity, they have a big boom and then you don't hear about the brand ever again. Mm-hmm. So we've always been cognizant of like, okay, when is the right time? You know, if you, using history lessons, Nike had been around for like 25 years before they got Jordan.
Yep.
I think they were already publicly traded when they, yep, when they got Jordan in 1985. So, you know, we've always kind of looked at that of like, okay, when we're ready, we're a great business, we have great profit. Okay, now we can manage it. Because I think if you use the Jordan example with a different business, you know, I think they sold $183 million in that first year on that Jordan 1. It just went nuts. They were, and you know,
I remember that. Like, you couldn't get them.
We know how, like, there's lead times with products. You have to order it. Nike was set up to have a lightning and a strike to execute against that well. Mm-hmm. So I think timing is so important with things. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier of not trying to stack too many things too early in business. And that's maybe one of our biggest lessons is just take it slow but fast. So do the daily things fast, but the bigger things slow. And over time, you'll look back and, you know, you've accomplished a lot. And I'm sure that's been the same for you guys.
Well, a couple things that just come to mind based on what you said. Number one, Cuts is positioned well for when the right opportunity is there, mm-hmm, to make it happen. That's the key. Mm-hmm. Like what I say that about us too. Like we've had plenty of good luck over, mm-hmm, time, but then we executed on it. Like we could have botched the Gordon deal, mm-hmm, you know, like we could have not gotten it done for whatever reason, being greedy, letting time get in the way, you know, or just not having the ability when the opportunity was presented to like negotiate, execute, and close it out. Mm-hmm. So you have to be in a position that when the good luck comes your way to execute on
it. You're ready to go.
You know? And I think Cuts is definitely there. So when the right one comes around, but
we'll be ready.
You know, but the other thing that is interesting about what you said is these like celebrity led brands. I think there is validity to the model because it is with social media and with just digital information, the ability to like spread something like wildfire,
yeah,
to like build on someone, that's a different phenomenon than probably even when you started Cuts.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think there is a place for those. But
the product,
you still have
good.
To have a good product. Yeah. There you go.
It comes back to that. Like it, I mean, there's good and bad examples everywhere. Like, you know, Kim Kardashian and Skims, it fit her body type. It was a problem that she was solving and that business is wildly successful and maybe one of the best ones. And she's such a beast. She crushes. But there's numerous examples, maybe without throwing, you know, shame on their names, but you know, that you could where the product and the person didn't make as much sense.
Sure.
One thing about that I want to guess is like the current state of where the market's at. You know, we came out of COVID the last couple of years, and the overall market has been turmoil to some degree. It's been down and then up a lot, and I think we've had a bad week recently, but it had been all time highs, and kind of seeing, you know, you said in '97, you saw the .com, and then the '08. Where are we in that mix? That, and how does that impact consumer in your mind? Like, how is Hexcat thinking about like where we're at, where like the market is in general right now?
Yeah, that's a good one to unpack. I mean, I think first of all there was a D2C bubble, right?
Mm-hmm. It kind of already bursted.
Yeah, it's burst, right? Yeah. The winners are what they are, and like there are a bunch of like relics, publicly traded companies, mm-hmm, that like shouldn't be, and they're just
Allbirds and some of those.
Yeah, like I don't want to bash anyone's name, but like those companies had no business being public in the first place, and they are. And that whole phenomenon of that era, that bubble, the COVID bubble or the D2C bubble, yeah, I think it's impacting all the good companies like yours and ours in terms of like the future from a financing perspective, et cetera. I always say there's always a market for good companies.
Yeah.
But there's been a big correction there. And then the question is now what?
Yeah.
And there was a lot of concern about the consumer. I think there is still a lot of concern about the consumer. Like on my way here, I was talking to my commercial banker, JP Morgan. And, you know, he was like talking about their credit team, and their credit team is very worried about the consumer.
But just then consumers are stacked with too much.
Yeah. Just like, spending, just like ability to spend, like ability to spend, the consumer's ability to spend. Now, the American consumer continues to defy all of the, you know, all the pundits out there. And I mean, I think there's reasons for that. I think that, you know, fundamentally, if you look at the world today, regardless of like the rise of China and all the geopolitical stuff, like the United States is
the American dream
at the top.
Still,
it's at the top, and there isn't a challenger. And that's the reason why it's still at the top, right? Because China was thought to be a challenger at one point. But if you look at what's going on in China, and I, by the way, I'm not like a China hater in any way. We manufacture some stuff in China. It is what it is. But I think China geopolitically and economically being like a command control environment, command and control economy, has kind of, it's like what Russia tried to do, right? And then the Cold War, and then they lost. Like they could never eclipse the US because they wanted to. So until there's like a real geopolitical challenge to the US, us just being on top and the dollar being the reserve currency of the world and everything else, like there's just like this ability of the United States economy to continue humming. We had a pretty, COVID was a pretty big like external shock that people didn't know was gonna come. And a lot of people suffered during COVID, but a lot of businesses did really, really well. So,
because the consumer, it almost pushed. Yeah, it was either you were on the losing end of consumers not doing that activity, i.e., restaurants, non-delivery restaurants, maybe theme parks, boat cruises, in-person stuff. But it almost opened up more income from the consumer standpoint to, you know, online businesses close. You know,
yeah, and then you know, overreaction bubble, the IPOs. Like I remember JP Morgan coming into our office and saying, oh, you know, high growth consumer is where it's at, being a best in class consumer brand. And you're a 18, 20 times EBITDA company. Mm-hmm. And about 6 months after that conversation, it was like, yeah, we take it all back, guys. Right? Like we take it all back. And that's fine. You know, there's probably a right middle ground, but you know, I definitely see some softness in the consumer right now.
Is it anything like, because it's not really like 08, because that was structural issues with like mortgages and things like that. Yeah. 97 to going into 2000 doesn't seem like that. Like, is there any, I always try to look for historical you know, lessons to kind of give you a little glimpse. And the one I've heard is maybe the 80s coming off of the 70s when it was more like stagflation. So it's not going to be like a big crash per se, but it could just be like slower GDP growth, slower spending. And then that kind of led into the 90s when Bill Clinton really had that balanced budget for the first time and he got the budget underway. And then that set up the growth for the next, you know, 10, 15 years or whatever it was. Is that a good...
So I actually look at what's going on today and what's gone on since like the pandemic ended. Mm-hmm. And I compare it a lot more to the dot-com bubble than I do to the global financial crisis. And that's probably because like that's really my sample.
Yeah.
I haven't really kind of looked back past, because I was, you know, the dot-com bubble, I was 27 years old.
Yeah.
And I was like right in the middle of it. Like I left, I was an M&A lawyer at Skadden and I went to go work at a dot-com company where I raised $15 million in venture capital.
Wow.
And like one day the investors, they just totally turned the page and were like, yeah, we're not funding businesses that aren't making money. And we're like, wait a minute, you were just telling us to spend. But like that's the, it was like a real whipsaw back then. And I think we've seen a real whipsaw in the market for D2C brands and consumer in general. So I think those are the two similarities, not so much the global financial crisis, because like you said, that was really about like a financial institutions run wild. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to me, like when you look at how the economy has evolved, we went from like a manufacturing economy to like a financing led economy. Like when GE was the darling of Wall Street, and GE was basically a finance company that also made like jet engines and some other things. And so now we're very much a tech-based economy with like with consumer spending. So we're like tech and consumer spending, and it's less about financial institutions and transactions like driving so much of the market. I mean, it's still very big, but so I look more at the dot-com era, and I just think that the consumer today is it is amazing to me, the resiliency of the American consumer. So I don't see any really massive headwinds.
Just a slow tightening.
Yeah, so maybe just a little bit. Yeah. And like, look, also for D2C brands, there's been a lot of issues with Meta lately.
Yeah.
And I think it's affecting people to varying degrees. It's definitely affected us, but there are so many
there's headwinds variables. And tailwinds all
there's
the
so
time.
Many variables in the equation of growth, right? Yeah. So it's like which variable is contributing more to it. And so we've seen that.
You got to have a great product.
There you go.
That's what we talk about the team all the time, is like we're only as good for us. It's a lot different where we have to come out with new products all the time. We have our hero items, which is our t-shirts and polos that customers don't want us to change, but that's not enough to continue growing. We have to come out with, like we were talking it with, you know, the different variations of the, you know, having a 30-inch inseam, things like that. As a company grows and you want to increase your TAM, you can't just rely on what got you here. For me, I feel like that's my biggest role moving forward, is being like the chief merchandising officer of really understanding, okay, where the opportunity is to grow and what products are we going to do to fulfill that growth. And that's where I'm spending most of my time now, is just really sinking into what does our consumer want? What does the guy like you want to wear every day? And I think that's really kind
of... And that's exactly what you should be focused on. Yeah. It's exactly what you should be focused on. And like when I just look at Hexbad, I look at Danny. Danny's been around the cookware space for a really long time. Mm-hmm. So he had when I joined 4 years ago, he had a roadmap of like all the things that we were going to start selling, and chief merchandising officer, like figuring out what are those pieces that we need to go build and drop, is like, you have to have a good product and you have to keep finding, you know, launching more good products. And I'm sure you have good people on your team to do it with, but at the end of the day, no one knows it. No one knows the brand like you and has the commitment that you have. So that's exactly what you should be doing, right?
Yeah, I always, I think with some of my mistakes have been, as the business grows, trying to delegate. Mm-hmm. And when there was a period in time in 2020 when we were growing like crazy, I think it was 140% growth that year. We were a small business, so we had smaller numbers, but just crazy growth. I said, hey, let's build out a product team. And we hired all these people on product. And then like the PO meetings came up and they'd be like, I think we should do, you know, this product. And in my head, I was like, no, that's not do it. But I wanted to, as a good CEO, I thought, hey, let's trust the people we've hired. And I knew it was going to be a disaster, but I didn't hold my tongue. And then, you know, we're still trying to get rid of some of those PO mistakes. And ever since then, I said, hey, everything but product, I'll be a great delegator to.
Right.
But product, I'm going to have a high, high, high bar of what I deem acceptable for cuts. And I think over the last 2 years, we've kind of written that, focus. But product is so important.
But it really is amazing that, like you said, you try to delegate these things. Mm-hmm. You want to delegate these things because you feel like that's what you're taught. Mm-hmm. That's what people say you should do. But, you know, unfortunately, there's no one that's as invested in it or as knowledgeable in it as you, because you've got so much skin in the game from your effort from day one, financially, mm-hmm. all the struggles, everything else. And I'm actually having the exact same problem right now, which is we've built out our team. We've hired great people. Mm-hmm. We have great people. But they're young, and they just don't have the time in the game. And that's, no matter how smart they are, they still need that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to find the balance between delegating and getting involved. And there's no way to like find it and keep it. It kind of like goes, it yo-yos, comes, right?
Yeah.
And like I'm like in June of 2023, I was like, I need to like take a little me time here, because I, you know, for 3 years I was like all Hexclad all the time.
Yeah.
And I love it. I loved it. But I found myself like all of a sudden it crept up on me that there were things missing in my life. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, I gotta do some things. Like, I gotta get a bit more in better shape and mm-hmm. find some other things to think about. And we, at the same time, like, we had this great team that we've been building, and I like delegated a lot to the team. Mm-hmm. And then in December, one of the team members came to me and was like, Jason, we need you at more meetings. We need you involved.
So it's
like
a yo-yo.
And I'm like, wait a minute. I'm like trying to delegate to you guys and gals, like, because you,
yeah,
because that's why we hired you. But it's just that presence.
And needs a leader to be there. Knows when he needs to come in and come out. And that's what makes a great leader, right?
Sure. I mean, hopefully, yeah. Hopefully I'm doing it right. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, the results. One of the last things that I always talk in on the pod is our vision is to inspire those to compete in the winning sport of business. For me, I love the competition of business, whether the highs or lows. And I love the lifestyle that it's provided me outside of the financial benefits. We're really just, you know, the actual day-to-day of learning lessons, talking to guys like you. Most of my friends now in my community that surround myself are founders, VPs of brands, other people in the space. And I've met a lot of amazing people. And, you know, when I look at around the business, you know, we haven't raised money. We're bootstrapped. We've employed, you know, in the U.S. hundreds of people now, overseas thousands of people with factories. And I'm super proud of what our impact outside of, you know, any social agenda, just the people working for mm-hmm. for cuts that wouldn't be there if we didn't create it. And, you know, with business specifically, there with younger generations and with all generations, and specifically my generation, the millennials, there's this negativity around like capitalism and business and for profits and all of that. So I wanted to kind of close it down with like what you love about the sport of business, and like, why do you do your job every day?
First of all, I love that sport of business tagline that you use. I think it's awesome. I love it. And human beings aren't naturally competitive. It's like hardwired into us. It's evolution and genetics, because we would be dead mm-hmm. if we weren't. So I totally feel you when you worry about like different generations and how they feel about it. But those are like luxury beliefs.
Yeah.
You know, it's a luxury. That's like being vegan. Like, go ahead, do you, right? But like, but that's a luxury to be a vegan. Like, if you're going to go to a foreign country where like vegan isn't a thing and they don't have your oat milk, like I'm sorry. Like,
you gotta
eat. That's a luxury yeah. belief. So I do think there's, and maybe I'm putting like my cranky old man hat on right now, but
no, I
do really think that eventually life is going to slap you in the face. Mm-hmm. Unless you just have the luxury of it not doing so. I was just talking to someone recently who was telling me a story, like they had their niece had another family over, and the mom of another daughter was like, oh, you know, we don't have to keep score. You know, life doesn't have to be competitive. Actually, it does. So there's a reason why they call it winning, being a winner mm-hmm. At something. It just has to be. And the scorecard is the P&L
yeah.
of a business. It's very simple. And so the sport of business is a great way to think about it. And I just, you know, I always say the cream rises to the top, and Cuts is rising to the top, and Hexclad is rising to the top because of that mentality. Mm-hmm. And although there's a lot of publicity around like how people's attitudes are different mm-hmm. these days about like having that killer instinct, what makes me feel good is that I meet lots of young people who are killers.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You know, you want to sit at this table, you need to be a killer.
Mm-hmm. And no, there's no handouts. We donated shirts to Working Wardrobes. And one of the things that the lady said, Working Wardrobes is a charity for either veterans or homeless people that are getting into the workforce. So once a year we do a sale and we donate shirts to them. And it's a perfect, it fulfills our vision to help people compete in the sport of business with new shirts. Mm-hmm. And it's a good way it's a good blessing to them. And one thing she said to me was, you know, this older lady that, she's like, we don't believe in giving a hand out, or hand out. We give a hand up. Mm. So she like, they help people up, but they're not going to give someone money just for a handout. And when I heard that, I was like, wow, I love that quote. Because I think in business, it's great to, you know, like I can call you, hey, can you give me a hand up on this? Like who are you using for growth, or, you know, what challenges on Meta are you doing? People are willing to help you, but you're not going to sit there and say, hey, you know, you're not going to make my business successful. I got to do it myself. And I think that mentality of, you know, being okay with advice and getting, you know, help from people, but you gotta just get it done yourself. And I like that, the vegan analogy, because it's so true. It's like life is gonna slap you in the face one day, and you're gonna know that, you know, it's not all sunshine and rainbows.
Yeah, I mean, I've been slapped in the face by life many times, mm-hmm. and but my competitive nature,
you love it.
It's just like yeah. I mean, you're going to either get back up or not. And it's
about like relishing in those difficult times of taking it. You know, I love whether athlete analogies with Kobe, when he loved to play defense against the best player. When Michael Jordan came to town, he knew he was the best, but he couldn't wait to compete against them. That's how me and you are. And that, like, I love that aspect of just getting the opportunity to compete.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, this is awesome. Thank you very much for having me.
Appreciate it.
Really appreciate it. And I'm hoping I'm going to come home with some.
Yeah, Jeremy's got you. Gear. Thank you, my man.
Always a pleasure. Talk soon.